Hello and welcome to Millennial 2017 number 18. This is with that guy T. And after some connection difficulties, we managed to sort out his internet is down, so we're having to do it from his phone, and that was a bit more complicated because I've never done that before. So anyway, hello that guy T.
Hey Wills, how's it going, man?
Very well now, very well. I'm glad that we sorted this out, because I was looking forward to this particular hangout, because I think people are intrigued by you, honestly. You started out as a libertarian, and now would you describe yourself as a black nationalist?
I'm not quite sure. Possibly, I definitely have sympathies for ethno-nationalism, particularly black nationalism. I just think it's an easy way to resolve the issues that we're facing in terms of the growing identity politics between our two circles, our two communities, racial communities. So in that sense, I guess you could say I'm a black nationalist, but in the same sense, I still value individualism, which I think a lot of people believe that you can't do the two. I can't do both. You can only either value nationalism and just reject the individual outright, or just solely believe in the individual and abandon any sense of community or nationhood or, you know, anything like that. Any collectivism.
Well, people get really autistic about this, and they'll say, you're a collectivist, that you obviously don't believe in liberty or the individual. Or you'll get collectivists who'll say, whatever, the opposite. And I really think it's just silly, because obviously you can combine the two, and obviously there is not a contradiction. And to be honest,
yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say there would be a contradiction at all. In fact, I would say it just makes sense. It's just, when I was a libertarian, I was constantly berated by a lot of people, particularly egalitarians and, classical liberals, as, not being pragmatic, because I'm still far in libertarian anarcho-capitalist. And the constant argument that I had against me was, you got to be pragmatic. These arguments, these ideas aren't pragmatic enough. They're not practical. They're not going to ever really work in theory. When I kind of now give the same critique of, egalitarianism to others, and, this idea of blinding individualism, I think that's highly impractical. And, this idea of, universal association, how, everybody's got to be like a melting pot. I just don't see it as being realistic.
Mm. And that's interesting, because obviously you're a black guy and you've grown up in a very multiracial, multicultural America. And obviously there is this, for people in the alt-right, which is fundamentally a white thing, white movement, we are often berated for just, we can't handle other cultures, or we hate other races, which I think by and large is simply untrue. And then there is the other thing about that you don't believe in liberty, which again is, I think, just a false dichotomy. It's just a misnomer.
Yeah, and I would say, in the sense of, the alt-right, like most people assume the alt-right to be, like you said, when they assume it to be just a sole hatred of other races, or, you just don't want to associate with them because you can't compete with them. You're afraid of them. You're afraid of blacks, or you hate blacks. You demonize them, like you're racist or something like that. When in reality, I do believe that there are many in the alt-right, I would say, that do hold animosity towards other races. But then again, there's many in the black community, or, I'm sure in Asian communities or Latino communities, that hold animosity towards other races as well. You could ask anybody on, the prominent black Twitter, if there's any racism directed at blacks from, Latino groups or from Asian groups. It's not an exclusively white thing. And in the same sense, we enact racism and prejudice in ways against whites, as well as against, Asians and other groups too. So this idea that, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, what you end up finding is it's just that people simply don't want the stress of living and interacting all the time with other groups, because it makes everything more complicated. And people always seem to have this feel this drawback to their own group, even when they have complicated feelings about their own group. You know, there is still
exactly, there's idea too. When I remember a prominent one of my good friends, Sargon of Akkad, who I think you had, I believe you had on Millennial.
Yeah,
he always. Well, I don't know. Always, I'm not going to gas myself up over that, but. Quite, I've heard him say more than a few times, or make a reference to how he enjoyed my video called "Why Black People Hate White People," and where I try to go into depth and explain the reality of how thick identity politics is within the Black community. And he seemed to agree in that, you know, yeah, the Black community is super identitarian, and that's why we need to promote egalitarianism to remove it. Whereas at the same time, I found myself when making that video journeying into the, you know, the greater need for decentralization and free association to reduce identity-based conflicts, not necessarily reduce identity politics, but just remove the, you know, wherever the gears are grinding incorrectly, which is basically, I believe, to be multiculturalism and, you know, just voluntary secession among, you know, different racial groups and balkanization. I think that's an inevitable natural occurrence. And I think that's an easy way to reduce a lot of the race-based conflict that we find ourselves having.
Yeah, I think there are systems in place just now to do two things. A, keep the races together, rubbing up alongside each other, and B, stoking tension between the races. And so, I mean, it's two unnatural situations at once, you know, because on the one hand, if two peoples clash together, generally speaking, they will find some way to handle that, either by one of them conquering the other, or they'll just reach some kind of compromise. But the race grievance industry today ensures that the clash goes on, and the reasonable compromises never actually take place. It's got to be this constant pressure to mix, especially to the disadvantage of the whites, because they are the dominant group just now. Just now. So it is essentially a deconstruction process that's going on, and that is perpetuated. But you seem to think that it's inevitable that, well, identity politics will intensify, because I imagine that. Well, I don't know what Sargon would say about this, but I think he would say it's avoidable and should be avoided. I would say it shouldn't be avoided, because these are distinct, you know, sacred identities that are being destroyed. And also, I don't think it can be avoided anyway. I think that it's something that is resurging now after many decades of an unnatural situation being imposed. I think that, you know, racial identities and even within that, ethnic and religious and so on, I think people are now retreating or returning, let's say returning to those things, because this, the situation that we have today just is stressful for people.
Yeah, and it's not something that's new either. You know, I also say returning is a good way to put it, because, you know, this was the norm, you know, this level of identity politics, I would say even more so than now. It was the norm about, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And I think we've had a sort of artificial suppression of people's natural inclination to, you know, voice identity politics. And the idea that it's in any way avoidable or unteachable, like try and indoctrinate people into egalitarianism and steer them away from, you know, their natural self-interest in regards to their own personal ethnic group or cultural group, I think is ridiculous. I just don't see that as being in any way a realistic solution to the issue at hand.
Yeah, I think the only people who fall for that are white people, and even then it's middle class white people. And even then they still look after their own interests. You know, they preach it for everyone else, like the useful idiots that they are. But then they ensure that their own kids grow up in a white area. You know, basically everyone else seems to not fall for this.
Yeah, it goes to the common, normicon argument in regards to, all these white Democrats, talking about, how we need to, we need more introduction of refugees, we need more multiculturalism, we need less gentrification of black communities, but they're all living in suburbia, gated picket fence communities where 99.9% of their daily interactions are with other white people. Inner cities and diverse inner cities, as far as living standards, there's still massive divides. And no matter how much you would see, the average leftist virtue signaling about how not racist they are and how, multicultural they are and how, intersectional they are, they'll still be living in their preferred comfort zone, which is going to be a white majority community.
Yeah, one thing I am interested in is to what extent that is not the case. I mean, do you think that, because obviously what the advocates of diversity would say is that we are increasingly happy in multicultural situations and multiracial situations, and that's why there are more mixed marriages nowadays, and people have friendship circles that involve every race and so on. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's just wishful thinking on their part?
Could you repeat that question a little bit more for me?
Well, do you think that people are, like the barriers between groups are being dissolved and people are more comfortable with diversity, or do you think that's just a delusion?
I don't know if it's a delusion. I think people are starting to cope with diversity. I don't know if they're necessarily becoming, more used to it or seeing it as a desirable thing necessarily. But I think they're starting to, trying to rationalize how to exist within it, because it's being forced onto people's communities, whether they like it or not. And particularly white people are, faced with the reality of either I have to, deal with this and, kind of, in a way, dilute their own cultural norms in terms of like also trying to negate theirs and suppress theirs while bringing in and accepting and embracing, alien cultures to them, cultures which maybe not alien to them, I wouldn't say, but just cultures that aren't, ingrained in their history. And while I don't think that they're becoming more accepting of diversity in terms of it being a good thing, I think they're just becoming more accepting of it in terms of it being a thing in general, of it being reality. And with that, you can't really tell if there's any authentic or genuine, desire for it, because it's like you can't really tell if someone's really just happy, if let's say Jane is really happy that, Jerome just moved in next to her, or if she's just putting on a good face so she's not being called racist and just saying, oh yeah, I love it, and when in reality, she's very uncomfortable. You can't really tell these days.
The Ballad of Jane and Jerome. That's very interesting. I was aware of you before we did that hangout with Roaming Millennial and Greg Johnson. I don't know when that was. Was that like March or April or something?
Yeah,
like
it was around. It was earlier, 2017.
Yeah, and I was aware of you before then, but since then I've watched more closely your sort of development, and especially on Twitter. Actually, I wonder if you'll get thrown off Twitter along with the rest of us on the 18th. I do wonder.
Well, yeah. He banned my first account, so the second one, more than likely, we'll see if it garners popularity.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder. It might just be a matter of being visible. You can get away with, it's like on YouTube, you can get away with controversial stuff when you're a tiny channel, but once you're big, they've got more eyes watching it and more people reporting it. But I've watched your development, and it's hilarious because often it seems like you're agreeing with what people in the alt-right say about things, but usually with a sort of, a certain ironic perspective. It's like you're watching white people either collapse into delusion, or and some of them, and others of them, sort of awakening to a reality. And you're sort of watching this play out as an outsider to that. And I find that quite interesting to watch.
Yeah, and it's interesting to be a viewer of it as well, because in the context of it being sorry, I'm trying to get my thoughts together. I just had a good thought and I lost it. But
don't worry. Yeah. Some white people deluding themselves and others getting quite hardcore, and some of them get really hardcore. You know, once they sort of get exposed to alt-right ideas.
Yeah, and it's a lot of people have a natural reaction to that when they see it and think, I don't know, I guess it's a fear. You know, they say, oh my God, you know, these crazy racists and Nazis are, you know, this is from the leftist perspective, these crazy Nazis and racists are, you know, inciting hatred and, you know, making it unsafe for minorities. Whereas the egalitarian perspective is, oh my God, these, you know, crazy Nazis and racists are inciting identity politics and, you know, bringing back to light what we've been fighting for so long to destroy. And my perspective is more so that of, hey, these guys are actually offering the only tangible solution that I think is realistically achievable without some sort of, you know, force being levied against another person. Because contrary to a lot of people's understanding, I am still very much a libertarian. There's a few caveats to my libertarianism now, which I plan to explain in future videos, in terms of like the universalism and the, you know, liberalism of most modern libertarian philosophy, which I don't really ascribe to anymore. But I am still very much a libertarian, and that's why I came to these conclusions and seeing what the alt-right's proposing as being tangible and somewhat achievable, because it's simply decentralization. It's simply free association and freedom of disassociation, which I think is the easiest way to reduce conflict.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that does interest me, there is a stereotype, but also backed up by statistical evidence that libertarianism is not popular with black people. And, you know, I know this is a crass question, but how do you think you ended up like this? I mean, what was your upbringing like?
My upbringing was pretty basic, I guess. I had a, you know, average, you know, cordial, well-off relationship with my mom. My dad, he's around. And he's also a very staunch black nationalist. He's more racist than most Nazis that I've come across. And he'll defend that. So in that, I've always kind of had someone in my ear telling me, you know, like telling me about, you know, Dr. Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, the other guy's name, like really Louis Farrakhan. And I've had all those ideas, you know, promoted to me through my dad for a pretty long time. And I never really took him in or took him seriously. I always thought like, yeah, that's definitely that progressive when I was younger, thinking, you know, that's it's kind of old school, you know, thought of, you know, yeah, black people are black people. We got to focus on us. Don't trust white people. But even though I still don't really take into consideration, I still don't hold that viewpoint in regards to whites. I don't, you know, have any inherent distrust or inherent opposition to white people. I realize that a lot of black people do. And rather than trying to teach every black person in the world, hey, you know, get rid of this, you know, ingrained thought pattern within our culture, maybe we can just maintain that ingrained thought pattern and build on it to where we can make our own communities better through it. And I know that's kind of a hard idea for some people to grasp, you know, like making your community better through embracing racism, but I think there's merit to it. And I kind of explained that in the video that I made called The Utility of Racism.
Yeah, I mean, for my own purposes, I think it's important to emphasize that when we say racism here, we're really talking about just in-group preference, simply a preference for your own kind. I mean, I once used the word racism in a title of a video, and that was used as evidence that I am like a classical racist, you know? And I really don't think I am. I understand why a lot of people are, because of their own experiences and whatever. But I think that it's just not necessary. I think that simply understanding that you have a group, you have a people, and that you have a duty to them, and that they can benefit you, and indeed that they created you in the first place, is more than enough. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. In fact, it would be wrong to negate that, to ignore it in your thoughts. So
yeah,
when people say, so you go.
I was just saying, just so I can input this here, because I know somebody somewhere down the line is going to say, you know, try to do the Roman millennial thing with me. You softball, this white nationalist, just agreeing with them and just chatting it up and laughing. So I'll pose a challenge to you in that, granted, when we say racism, we're all talking about preferences and group preferences, of course. But in regards to your own personal in-group preferences, I have noticed that, you know, what some people would describe as, you know, the negative side of racism, you may hold some of those qualities, because I recall there was one video. I don't think I ever saw it on your channel specifically. I think it was like a mirror from somebody else. And you were talking about how you were kind of unhappy with seeing, I believe it was Taylor Swift either dating or performing with like some sexualized black guy. And you were just like, that just rubs me the wrong way. I don't really like this. And some people would describe that.
Yeah, I can't remember what video that was, but I do remember what it was the rumor that she was now dating Drake, who I think he's actually a Jewish black guy. And that does disturb me, honestly, because it's like, I mean, especially with Taylor Swift, and I know that, you know, she's probably a fucking idiot, I know that, but she is, you know, gorgeous and an example of, you know, Aryan genetics. And no, I don't like the idea of those being compromised. So again, regardless of whether she's an idiot or not, I find her very attractive. And so there is that natural feeling that she is ours and she shouldn't, you know, go outside the tribe, the group, the people, whatever you want. So yeah, I guess that is classically, that's something that, you know, stereotypical racists would also say, for sure. But I don't think that it comes from malice. I don't think that it motivated by malice towards the other group.
Yeah, it's not anything malicious, not anything hateful. In fact, it's something that's quite common among most racial demographics. You know, it's very hard. It'll be very hard for me as a black guy to go and find love in China. I'm pretty sure there would be some quells within the family about, you know, purebred Chinese girl dating a black guy, you know, or a white girl, or if my family always tells me, you know, like, yeah, you know, even my mom, my dad is just straight up. He just says, yeah, don't bring a white girl home. I will not come to the wedding. And she was like that for a while, but then she kind of like toned it down. She was like, if you love her, maybe blah, blah, blah. But you know, she definitely would prefer I, you know, maintain, you know, a continuation of, I guess you could say, black genetics. And she wants me to be able to date within my race, and she would much prefer that. And I don't think that's anything malicious. You know, I don't think it's definitely a preference of one race above another. It's definitely, you know, I would say classical racism, but I don't think that's necessarily proof that someone's a bad person or proof that someone, I don't think that's something that needs to be disrupted. I don't think that's something that needs to be fought against. I think that's something that we could all calmly embrace, even the skeptics, you know, to an extent.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I mean, there is so much effort that goes into suppressing it that I think it's a very unnatural situation. I mean, one thing that does occur to me is that there is more ideology involved in, suppressing that than there is in simply accepting it. And again, there's a lot of money involved in this as well, because it's now become this quo that, you know, you've got to. I mean, in Britain, I made a video recently that our leading supermarket chains, they spend fortunes every Christmas now on Christmas adverts. And in, I think, I can't remember now, most of them this year have, they promote race mixing. You know, they've got a fucking mixed race couple at the heart of it. And it's like, how much money did you put into this? And, you know, it's not, I don't even know whether they're, the supermarkets themselves are making this decision or whether it's the advertising agencies, which is another matter. Because obviously certain interests tend to control advertising. But either way, a huge amount of money is going into that. And I often think, and this is something that I alluded to, I think, in the Sargon hangout, that if it weren't for certain interests interfering, the relations between the races could be far more simple and successful. Because they could just agree on certain things, whereas there is a grievance industry preventing them from simply reaching natural agreements. And that really is, and of course at this stage the grievance industry is just massive. I mean, it's part of government, it's part of academia, it's all over the education sector, it's in the lobbying sector, and it's everywhere. But if it were to be, you know, dissolved one way or another, or just ignored, then I think things could be a lot simpler. I don't think there is a need for this level of, animosity between the races. I mean, obviously two groups who find themselves coexisting in the same place are going to have conflict. You know, diversity plus proximity equals conflict. But that doesn't mean it needs to go on and on and on, or that it needs to be bloodshed. You know, and I also think at this stage, especially in America, and we're past that stage. It's not like we need to discover that, oh, there are tensions between us. Everyone fucking knows that. It's been going on for centuries.
Yeah, it's definitely obvious at this point, I would hope. And, you know, I don't think that there's any need for, like, if we agree that the animosity between the races exists and that the division exists, I don't think, even if you want to go about trying to resolve it, and through my intended purpose, which or preferred method, which would be dissociation, privatization, and balkanization of, you know, different groups. It doesn't necessarily even have to be racial lines, but also, you know, among gender differences. You know, I think that the pay gap myth will kind of die down once we stop having so much diversity within certain fields, at least forced diversity within certain fields. I think that the pay gap, you know, calling, or I just think that'll subside. And even through, like, dissociation, even if you take the alt-right perspective and say, you know, we're just going to separate the groups, we just can't live peacefully together, I don't even think even then, from my personal perspective, that it's an all or nothing thing. I don't think you have to say, you know, we're going to ship all the blacks back to Africa, you know, from an American perspective. I don't think you need to say we're going to ship all the blacks back to Africa, all the Asians back to China, and, you know, in some cases, even all the Europeans back to Europe, and just leave the Native Americans to, you know, build as many casinos as they want. I don't think that's necessarily, you know, I don't think that has to happen. I think that we can agree that there are certain divisions and certain lines and boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. There's certain, you know, internal prejudices and certain internal collective notions and collective, you know, feelings, I guess you could say, that should be preserved and maybe not necessarily sacrosanct, but just respected. And we can do that while still maintaining perhaps not a multicultural community, but I don't know what else you would call it. It wouldn't be, you know, the multiculturalism that we see today. It wouldn't be highly integrated. There would still be commerce between, you know, these different groups. There would still be interaction, association, but it wouldn't be multiculturalism. It would be something else, something much more, I guess, not divided, but territorial.
Yeah, discreet. I mean, certain boundaries would be respected. So some questions are coming in from the chat. One thing is about, yes, ask T what he thinks about Mexicans possibly breeding American blacks out. The numbers are against black people here because Hispanics or Mexicans are so numerous, and they're not, you know, they're more openly racist against black people. What would you say about that?
I say it's definitely a concern that the black community has. I don't know if it's necessarily a concern that I have. It's something that I realize the reality that, you know, especially particularly in America, that Latinos are going to outbreed and outnumber blacks as well as whites, as well as Asians, as well as any other demographic in this region. And in that, I think a lot of black people are starting to realize that, you know, minus all of the bullshit about, you know, uniting all people of color and how we're all just some sort of homogenous group and we all just look out for each other because we're minorities, Latino interests differ very heavily from black interests. And even if you're, you know, if you agree, which I think it's just factually correct, that both Latino and African-American interests are, at the moment, you know, they lean much more heavily towards leftism. Even if you acknowledge that and disagree with both because they're both leftists, you can understand that they're still fighting for their own in-group preferences, and they do so in different ways. So Latino interests contradict in many ways black interests, and black interests in many ways contradict Latino interests. And people have, you know, institutions and entities and, you know, the powers that be have been trying very hard to push this notion that, you know, the only interest that shouldn't be fought for is white. And if we can just remove white interests from the equation, then we can all, as, you know, minorities, as people of color, you know, universally benefit from a collective movement. Whereas that's not the case. And I don't think that's ever going to be the case. I think black people are realizing that that cannot be the case. And because of that, we're starting to see the breakdown of, you know, once established
Oh, no, you've gone silent, T. Oh, shit. Let's see what happens now. Sorry, everyone.
Am I back?
Yeah, you're back. They were making jokes in the live chat that the Mexicans shut you down and so.
Okay, so I don't know exactly what you heard and what just fell off, but
yeah, I think you'd made the point. There is this. Previously, it was the case that all these minority groups were encouraged to think of themselves as a salt, as one block against the white majority, whereas now that illusion is coming apart. Again, this is another manifestation of identity politics emerging. You know, the identities of each of these groups.
Yeah, and it's something that blacks are going to have to, you know, come to realize. And Once they do start to realize that, they're going to have to think of new ways to still promote their interests and do that without necessarily, you know, do that absent multiculturalism. Because this idea that once Latinos become the majority, which I think is going to be inevitable, that our politics are always going to align and they're going to fight for our interests, we just realize that that's just incorrect. Which is why I plan on starting a series, quite a long series. I'm on a hiatus right now on my YouTube channel, but I plan on starting a very long series called, I think it's going to be called something like New Black America or something like that, in which I want to like start promoting ideas of how Black people can, you know, encourage. I want to encourage Black betterment. Not necessarily, you know, multiculturalism or equality or togetherness or diversity or anything like that. I just want to encourage Black betterment. You don't have to, you know, believe as a Black person that we're all equal and we should all be in this melting pot together and, you know, all believe in the Constitution and just all be Americans, you know, just hold a sole consumeristic American identity. I believe that you can be a Black identitarian and still fight for Black betterment without necessarily trying to oppose the same identitarian measures that whites take to fight for their betterment or Latinos take to fight for their betterment. And I hope to explain some of that going forward.
Right. Okay. That's something that we've not even talked about is the issue of American identity, because obviously America... I mean, it's now the case that, you know, every Western European country we are told that every Western European country is multiracial and has always been multiracial. And so the identity of being a Swede is not tied to an ethnic background at all. But that's now the case everywhere. But I think it's been the case for slightly longer in America. This seems to have been piloted in America. The idea that to be an American, you don't need to be any particular race. America is the melting pot, the melting pot. And I think, again, what would you say about, well, just the question of American identity and race? Do you think that idea is again coming apart? Do you think it was ever true? Do you think people ever really believed that?
Like, believe the idea that, you know, race didn't exist anymore and we were all just Americans?
Yeah.
No. I don't think anybody believed that. I don't think anybody still believes that. I think a lot of people, I think some people do believe that currently, mainly white conservatives, like white, normally Republicans. I think some of them, some just random, regular, you know, run-of-the-mill constitutionalists, Tea Party guys, still actually believe that, you know, we're all just Americans, and the only thing that matters is our loyalty to the flag and our loyalty to the Constitution and, you know, the whole Constitution meme, you know, quote Murdoch Murdoch. There's plenty of people who still believe in that, but most people, I think the vast majority understand that that's not a reality, that's never been a reality, and to portray that as something that was real, it's almost kind of like the same idea of, you know, like when Blacks criticize whites for saying, you know, I don't see color, when, you know, Black people recognize that that's bullshit. In the same sense, you know, I don't see any identity, I only see Americans, I only see red, white, and blue. Bullshit. Of course you see the different interests between these groups. Of course you see how X demographic affects your own personal interests, whether that be socioeconomic, whether that be through your safety, your comfort, your property values, or just your own personal ideological, philosophical beliefs. You see that these things are not mutually aligned among all these different demographics. So if you recognize that is true, to then follow up by still pushing the same false narrative of we're all just Americans, we're all just, you know, one big happy United States, it's just dishonest. And I think there's a lot of conservative brands and conservative firebrands who recognize that this is true, but yet still push the, you know, one America, you know, America first, make America great again, you know, red, white, and blue together, multicultural melting pot crap. Because, like you said, there's a lot of money invested into that narrative, into that space. Because people assume that the only people getting funding right now are, you know, the SJWs, you know, by George Soros. And that's the only, you know, group that's, you know, vested in multiculturalism that's getting, you know, all this artificial funding to, like, push out propaganda. When the right also has the same problem. There's plenty of conservatives who are getting plenty of money from, you know, multicultural or people who have interest in, you know, pushing multicultural propaganda, and they're mirroring this on their YouTube channels, on, you know, their talk shows, on their college tours, and they're just pushing this same crap that leftists are pushing, but from a perspective that is more appealing to most conservative pundits, you know, your average Fox News viewer.
Yeah, and it's also more naive than the version on the left, because the left know what they're doing. I think that conservatives genuinely believe these things that they're saying. I mean, it's funny that you homed in on conservatives, like mainstream conservatives, as the ones who really believe this. Because I was watching I did a video recently about the Prager University. They did a video talking about the alt-right. And they were obsessed with the individualism thing and America's a land of opportunity and all that. And again, it just seems so childlike.
That video was hilarious. There was one point in that where you, I forgot what point the guy was making, but I said it before you even said it. What was the point? I don't know. It was at one point where you just flat out responded to him and just said, "This is just fucking retarded." I can't remember the argument, but it was so stupid. It was such a stupid point. I wish I could remember.
Yeah, there were quite a lot of things in that video. I think it was like 15 minutes long, actually. So I did rant a bit. I can't remember all the things I said. I think at one point he was saying that you know, the pioneering entrepreneurialism and all this is... I can't remember. They've just... I think that American... Well, actually, British conservatives as well have this idea of themselves as the preservers of civilization. And so anything which is alien to them is just a disaster. It's just anti-civilization. But the irony is that what they end up doing, you know, the values that they supposedly believe in, they change every 10 years. You know, they get the new update from the liberals. And then they just end up parroting what the liberals have been saying. So it's a very... The modern conservative, the modern mainstream conservative, is a very strange creature. You know, very delusional, indeed. Okay. There was one other question that somebody asked. Oh yeah, yeah. Ask him what black women think of the black man, white woman agenda.
Come on, you guys already know what they think. You know, the white women's taking all the good men's out here. Now I can't find no good men's. You know, the only reason that I got, you know, 12 baby daddies and, you know, I'm on food stamps. It's all because, you know, all the good men, all the rich black men, the NBA players and the rappers, because they want to go for foreign girls. They want to go for the white girl, the Becky, and they want to go for, you know, the hot Latina and all that good shit. That's the narrative.
I'm not, obviously I don't live in America, so I'm not privy to that up close, but I have heard of it, that there right. are a lot of black women who really resent this thing, that's the fact that particular combination is being pushed all the time in the media, like the black man and the white woman.
Yeah, which really goes contrary to the idea of the strong, independent black woman. You know, I don't know if you saw the hashtag black women trending on Twitter yesterday or day before. So black women are powerful enough. Yeah, it was black women was trending because they were saying black women successfully defeated or were the sole, you know, entity that was responsible for successfully defeating Roy Moore. Or in Alabama.
Oh, yes.
In the election.
Yes, I did see this. Yeah, I did see this. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're powerful enough and, you know, competent enough and, you know, have enough resources to defeat fascism, according to the, you know, all the leftist outlets. They can defeat fascism and, you know, make America great again, you know, and save America from, you know, this evil, racist establishment, but they still can't find a good man. I don't know. Maybe it's just a lot harder to find somebody who's not, you know, it's much harder to find a good father figure to, you know, raise your children than it is to just shift the entire political paradigm in America.
All right. Let me have a look at the chat, see if there are any more questions for you. All right.
Damn, I wish I was able to have it open. I'm sure it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite shitposty. Oh, they want you... What do you think about the Black Panthers and Malcolm X?
Well, I guess that's a two-part question because I think the modern Black Panthers are a lot different than classical Black Panthers. Because one thing, the new Black Panther movement, I think that's what they go by, they're not quite, there's nowhere near as boisterous or nowhere near as well-known as Black Panthers were in, like, the, you know, 50s, 60s and such. So, well, let's start with the Malcolm X part. I have a lot of respect for Malcolm X, and I have a lot of respect for Malcolm X's philosophy. I don't agree with it in its entirety, in that I don't agree because I'm a capitalist. I still have this, you know, inherent intrinsic belief in maybe not multicultural association, but multiracial and multicultural economic association, if right. That makes any sense. And that's something that Malcolm X wasn't really a fan of. He was more such, you know, in terms of, like, you know, building Liberia, you know, going back to Africa, building up our own homeland, which I think is good. I don't think any Black American is ever going to do that. I don't think they're ever going to take that charge, not only because their ideology right now is, you know, the same leftist bullshit that's impoverished Blacks for generations. So if you just shift that to Africa, you know, and add in all the corruption and internal conflict and war, yeah, good luck Africa being a nice fucking place to live. But even aside from that, I don't even think they have a desire to, you know, go back to Africa and build their own homeland up. So I disagree with Malcolm X in that regard, but I do agree with him in regard to, I guess, valuing a Black identity. Whereas Martin Luther King, more so, he valued a Black identity, but he wanted to switch that or reverse it to having a Black, Afrocentric interest in terms of, and switch that to have a multicultural interest. And that's something I disagree with.
Yeah, he was far more the tool of, you know, globalists, global interests.
Yeah, and in that, I would say I'm much more, if you could describe any of my views as being, you know, Afrocentric or Black nationalist or anything like that, I would much more lean towards Malcolm X's brand of, you know, preserving or going forward with trying to achieve Black interests or Black betterment than Martin Luther King's vision of trying to do the same thing. In the same sense, I guess the same critique would apply to the Black Panthers. You know, I don't believe in the, like, having, you know, a militant opposition to whites. I don't believe in having a militant opposition to capitalism and things like that. But in the same sense, I also believe in having a very strong, you know, belief in, you know, privatization, you know, self-determination, property rights among Blacks, economic betterment and economic prosperity within our own community, built through our own communities, and not outsourced, you know, basically making Blacks non-dependent. And also, of course, you know, the guns thing, you know, having a strong Second Amendment vibe within our culture. I agree with Black Panthers in that sense. And of course, the hatred of white people, I'm not so much on.
Right. That kind of links on to another question. Someone's asking what they've just said, ask him about hood culture.
Could you repeat
it's very broad. What do you think about hood culture?
It's it's something that I think is, it's easy to glamorize. It's easy to make that seem desirable, especially, you know, I think it's easy to market that as desirable to white youth, I would say. Youth in general, but particularly white youth. Because it's easy to market, you know, the bad boy. You know, it's the same thing with greasers, you know, like you can market, you know, the bad boy vibe to the communities of, you know, very prosperous, very, you know, well-educated, you know, normal picket fence, you know, lifestyles. You can market, you know, it's like the white girl who, you know, finds the greaser attractive because her life is so boring. It's so, you know, traditional. It's so normal. And it's like, oh man, but this guy, he's so cool. You know, he's like, you know, he's a bad boy. You know, he rides motorcycles, wears leather jackets, you know, and, you know, that's why your daughter ends up riding off into the sunset with this, you know, degenerate, because it's cool. In the same way, hood culture, I think, is cool. You know, I don't think it's anything that's good. I don't think it serves any particular benefit to society. But nonetheless, it's something that, you know, makes for a good movie. It makes for a good show. And when you people aren't able to dissect reality from, you know, I guess movie culture or fiction, that's when you get people to say, oh, I want this culture integrated into mine because I want to live this lifestyle, because I find it interesting, I find it edgy, I find it cool. And yeah, I think
it's thrill of the exotic.
Yeah. And I think that applies to, you know, other realms as well in regards to the refugee crisis, you know, the migrant crisis, where you say maybe of course, you know, everybody wants the good food, they want the shawarma and stuff like that, but absent the glamorization and the, you know, the capitalist side of, you know, what's good about a particular culture, you know, basically what you can buy off a shelf from a culture, the internal, you know, negatives, they're not really highlighted or showcased. And you don't realize how bad this culture really is until you bring it to your culture, which is doing well. And then once your culture starts to degrade, you start to realize, holy shit, maybe this lifestyle isn't as cool as it once was. You know, because you can ask any black person in the world, you know, granted, I think a lot of them are, you know, complicit in their stagnation of living in, you know, the hood, for lack of better words. But every black person will still say, my dream is to get out of the hood. You know, it's classic cliche all the way back to Tupac, all the way back to fucking slavery, probably before then, probably back in Africa. You know, every black person says, I want to get out of the hood. And that's just a notion, because it's not a good culture. It's not something that, you know, is prosperous. It's not something that breeds any beneficial result to the overall net society. So I think that white people don't really realize that, don't really comprehend how, you know, corrupt and toxic hood culture really is. But it's easy to market to them because, you know, I was watching a 21 Savage video yesterday. He's an upcoming rapper. And I was just watching and just seeing, like, all of the, he was doing a live performance. And I was just seeing how many of his fans were white. How much of the demographic that loves his stuff was white. And I know these guys aren't living in the same hood that he came from. And while that same type of music and same type of lifestyle is glamorized by the black community as well, the difference is we glamorize it, but we want better than what is shown. Whereas white people, I think, glamorize it, already have better than what is shown, and kind of want, you know, to taste the exotic, as you would say.
Yeah. And also, they don't appreciate what they've got. I mean, it's this thing about flirting with destruction, which is definitely a white thing. It's part of the white psyche, is this a certain fascination with self-destruction. And I think, you know, that's inside an individual, but also in societies as well. And I think that this obsession with this fetishization of hood culture is definitely an example of this. It's like, well, what would happen? I would be so much more free without this bourgeois lifestyle and this awful suburban prison that I was raised in. And really, no, you wouldn't be more free, and you wouldn't be happier either. But they don't appreciate that because, like, you know, it's so easy to take this stuff for granted.
Yeah, and I don't know what's going to, you know, what's going to be the turning point to where if they realize that's the case. But, you know, hopefully, I would hope that it happens one day.
Oh, yeah. I think, again, it's just an example of white lack of confidence, lack of self-confidence. Because most people, I mean, you've always got outliers and rebels who are going to seek out, well, the exotic, the forbidden, and so on. But most people are quite conformist. And I think there's a reason, you know, when a large number of people are seeking out the exotic and the forbidden, there's some cultural reason for that. And I think that it's basically the white culture, white society doesn't have the self-confidence that it used to have. So it pushes white youth towards that kind of stuff. I mean, there isn't a defense against it.
And in that same sense, do you think the alt-right can possibly make white people develop redevelop a appreciation of white culture? Do you think that's possible? The ones that are already...
I think it's possible. I think that it will have to develop into something more general than it is just now. You know, the alt-right just now is quite sharp and brash. And I think that in order to appeal to, you know, the mainstream, it's going to have to become more mainstream. So that's something that I would see. You know, obviously any subculture in its early years is going to be, well, like the alt-right has been. You know, it's going to be brash and aggressive and not really give a fuck about what people, you know, who's offended. But eventually, if it's going to mature, it has to become more mainstream friendly. And then I think we will be able to engender more self-confidence and more faith in white identity and white culture. But we're not there yet, but I do think it's coming.
Yeah, because I noticed the alt-right in what they're doing now, they're very appealing. I guess they appeal very much to the non-novice, the person who understands politics, who understands the reality of, you know, demographics and IQ and, you know, all these other disparities, you know, these different academic justifications and academic reasonings for preserving whiteness. But in terms of appealing to the normies, in terms of appealing to the layman, I don't think you can really, well, I don't know how to say I don't think they can, but I haven't seen any real strong attempt to try to compete with normie propaganda in a way that is, you know, fun, in a way that's, you know, chill and relaxed and not necessarily, you know, academic or philosophical, but just something that just appeals to the baseline, you know, the baseline desires. Yeah,
I think that's something that we're going to have to get into. But again, it's part of the movement maturing into something more for the long term, actually. So, anyway, I think I should cut it there because the next hangout is due to start in 15 minutes. So I should get ready for that one. But this has been a really interesting discussion, and I'm glad to have finally had you on the channel. So thanks for appearing. I hope this was enjoyable for you. Oh, God, have you gone silent again? I think his connection's gone again. That's very unfortunate. Okay, well, I'll just end it here. I hope this was interesting to everyone else, and I'll be back in about 15 minutes with Thomas Baden Rees, and I'll ask him how to pronounce that name correctly because I'm never sure. Okay, well, he's absent, but I will say thank you to that guy T for appearing, and thank you to everyone for listening. I'll see you soon.